From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The design company IDEO worked on the first Apple mouse, the Palm 5 handheld organizer, the Polaroid iZone instant camera, the Crest Neat Squeeze stand-up toothpaste tube, and an inflation device for angioplasty. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the general manager of IDEO, Tom Kelly. His new book, The Art of Innovation, tells the story behind the designs and suggests ways of creating a work environment that is conducive to creativity and innovation. He's written a new book called The Art of Innovation. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg tells us why the word literacy makes him uneasy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush sent his $1.6 trillion tax cut plan to Capitol Hill today, where it immediately drew fire from Democratic congressional leaders. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle stood beside a $43,000 Lexus to illustrate the Bush plan's benefit for the wealthiest taxpayers. There was also an old muffler to show how much middle-class taxpayers can expect.
The top 1% of all taxpayers in this country get 43% of the benefits provided in the Bush tax plan. 43%. The bottom 60% of all taxpayers get 29%. We don't think that distribution makes any sense at all.
House Minority Leader Dick Gephardt said Democrats want a tax cut, but not like the Republicans.
We're never going to have all the features their tax bill will have. Can't do it. Can't happen. Won't happen.
Gephardt said Mr. Bush should have sent a budget to the Hill before a tax cut. David Wellna, NPR News, the Capitol.
California Governor Gray Davis says the state will speed up the approval process for building new power plants in an effort to head off blackouts next summer. Davis said the state's approval process can be cut to just 3 weeks for power plant operators who promise to have their generators online by next summer. He's asked President Bush to order federal regulators to issue the necessary federal permits in the same time frame. Davis said California will show that it's possible to eliminate red tape and provide more power without hurting the environment. The governor is hoping to provide enough power for 5 million homes before the state reaches peak electric demand this summer. The wreckage of two U.S. military aircraft that crashed in the Himalayas during World War II may have been located in Tibet. The Pentagon said today it's received information on the crash sites from the Chinese government and hopes to send a team to Tibet to investigate. NPR's Tom Gelton has more.
The Pentagon says the wreckage located in Tibet may include that of a C-46 transport plane lost on March 27, 1944, while flying from China over the Himalayas to India. Four crew members were aboard. They've been listed since that day as missing in action. The Pentagon is attempting to locate the families of the crew members and has not yet released their names. The second site is still under investigation. According to a Pentagon statement, the Chinese government told the United States last fall that it had discovered the two crash sites and then provided more details last month. The Pentagon's POW and Missing Personnel Office says it's seeking Chinese government approval to send a survey team to the two sites to gather information that could lead to a full-scale excavation. Tom Gelton, NPR News, The Pentagon.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 66 points to close at 10,880 in moderate trading. This is NPR News. Israeli Prime Minister-elect Ariel Sharon said he won't resume peace talks with the Palestinians until they stop attacks against Israelis. Sharon spoke after a car bomb injured at least one person in a Jerusalem neighborhood. An aide to Yasser Arafat says the Palestinian leader has told President Bush that he's committed to finding a peaceful end to the conflict with Israel. President Bush phoned Arafat today to urge him to do everything he can to stop the violence. New York State has become the first state in the nation to issue guidelines for hospitals to try to reduce the number of mistakes during surgery. NPR's Patricia Namond reports.
State officials estimate as many as 100 mistakes are made during surgery each year in New York hospitals, mistakes that result in the wrong body part or area of a patient being operated on. In one recent case, a surgeon was charged with performing surgery on the wrong side of a patient's brain. New York's guidelines recommend hospitals verify in three different ways the correct site of surgery. That includes marking right or left side on medical records, charts, and x-rays. If a mistake is made and the state finds out the hospital didn't follow its recommendations, the hospital can be fined. Nationwide concern about medical errors has grown, particularly since studies have shown as many as 100,000 patients die in hospitals each year due to medical errors. Patricia Nament, NPR News, Los Angeles.
The space shuttle Atlantis is in an orbit that should bring it to the International Space Station by midday tomorrow. The five astronauts spent their first full day in orbit checking their spacesuits and other gear they'll need to attach the new laboratory module to the space station. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, saluting cultural programming on NPR, recipient of the Year 2000 National Medal of Arts.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The first Apple computer mouse, the Palm 5 handheld organizer, the Polaroid iZone instant camera, and the Crest Neat Squeeze toothpaste tube are just some of the products that the design company IDEO has worked on. IDEO has won more design awards than any other company of its kind. My guest Tom Kelly is the general manager of IDEO. It was founded by his brother David. Tom Kelly has written a new book that is about design and about creating the kind of work environment that encourages innovation. The book is called The Art of Innovation. Let's start with something low-tech, the design of the Crest Neat Squeeze toothpaste tube, which stands up instead of lying on its side.
A large part of that design was done in-house at Procter & Gamble, but when they came to us, they were looking at the cap and the tip, and they were trying to make it as ergonomic as they could, and they were trying to deal with the issue of toothpaste gunking up the tip of a toothpaste tube. In fact, in the first meeting with Procter & Gamble, one of the managers there said, "We're going to save marriages with this product," you know, because people argue about who left the cap off the toothpaste and it got all gunked up. So looking at the cap and the tip, we said, okay, let's get those threads away from the tip of the tube, because that's what happens. You get a little toothpaste over the edge, and then it gets caught in the screw threads, you know, that you screw the cap on with. So we made this nice smooth surface there and moved the threads far away from it. And then we had this idea that the quote best solution was to have a cap that just pops on and pops off. So no screw threads at all. So it's neater. It's also easier for the customer to do. So we develop prototypes, as we always do, and we show it to consumers, and we're sure it's the, quote, perfect solution. Well, it's not the perfect solution for an American customer, because when we showed them to them, they try to screw the cap off, because they've been taking caps off of toothpaste tubes for 50 years, some of them, and they know how a cap comes off. It screws off. And so they would twist it and twist it and twist it and say, "What's wrong with this cap? It must be broken." And so even though it was the perfect solution in our minds, we have this process we call user-chooser, in which the people who actually use the products kind of get to decide. And so since they couldn't figure out how to use our cap, we did a modification so it's a single twist. It's not the, you know, six or seven threads that you see on a normal toothpaste tube. It's a single twist that comes off and then a single twist back on.
So there's fewer threads to gunk up.
Fewer threads, it's a much coarser thread. And then just as this is the kind of thing our engineers and human factors people spend a lot of time on, just as you're getting the cap closed, there's a little click. It's what the engineers call a detent that says, okay, gotcha, it's closed, you can stop turning now. And so we spend a lot of time looking at the tiny details like that, especially on a product like that that is going to be replicated literally hundreds of millions of times.
Now, it's funny way that you had to study how people use a tube of toothpaste, because I'm sure every designer who was working on that job has used toothpaste all his or her life and knew the drill.
Right. Well, this gets back to this principle we call innovation begins with an I, meaning you have to do observations even of things that are very familiar to you. Now, it is possible to observe yourself as you do something. But we think it's better to watch people as they do things, because you watch with fresh eyes, especially if you have a cognitive psychologist with you, and you will see things that you never noticed before. So in that similar category, we worked on kids' toothbrushes. And wow, you know, I had small kids at the time, and I never noticed all the things that kids do. One of the things we discovered is that adults hold a toothbrush in their fingertips, but kids fist the brush. They grab it in their whole hand. And so even though their hands are smaller, we discovered that kids need a fatter toothbrush. We also noticed that people, or that kids grab the toothbrush so close to the bristles sometimes that they can't even get the bristles in their mouth because their fist is in the way. You know, it keeps bumping up against their cheek. And so with that discovery, then we designed this toothbrush for Oral-B called the Squish Grip toothbrush that directed them, that had a little bump that kept them from sliding their hand all the way up.
And it's a fat handle so that they can use it by putting their whole hand around it, not just holding it in their fingers.
Yes, it's a fat, squishy handle that has now been widely copied, but was really the first to come out and is very popular with kids.
It's the same kind of principle as that fat-handled silverware for people who have had strokes or other problems that have diminished their hand strength or the control of their hands.
That's one of the things we notice, is when a product comes out aimed at someone who has some form of disability or impairment, often what is easier for them is easier for everybody. So the classic case is the big cap on the Liquid Tide bottle. They made it for people with arthritic hands. It's really fat, round cap, probably four times as big as caps used to be on liquid bottles. And what they discovered is arthritic people could open it easier, but everybody liked it. And so they've basically put it on all of their products.
Now, can I point out the one flaw of the fat, squishy toothbrush for kids?
Sure.
It doesn't fit into your average toothbrush holder.
I knew you were going to say that. Yes, I have exactly that problem, and I'm sorry to say I don't have a solution. I wish that Oral-B would ship with every fat toothbrush a little, you know, a little holder you could, like, glue on your mirror or something. But, yes, you're right. There are many toothbrush holders. We have switched toothbrush holders in the Kelly household because it doesn't fit in all of them.
You know, the Crest Neat Squeeze toothpaste tube that we were talking about that you participated in the design of, there's another brand that has an upside-down version of that. It also stands up, but it stands up on the cap instead of standing up on the bottom. And the cap is not a very stable base because the bottom is larger and heavier than the cap is. And so you stand it up on your sink and it falls over. Now, your company did not design it. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it and if you realize
we did not design it. And I have to confess I am not familiar with it. But that's the kind of thing in the prototyping process, as you build things and try them and fix them and make them better and go through a lot of iterations before you go to market, typically you would discover that, especially if you let real humans at your prototypes. As long as you only let the designers and engineers Adam, and then you later show them to the executives and you say, it just sits like that, just sit it down delicately, or you give them some kind of clue, and they'll always get it right. The problem is when you put the product into distribution in, say, Walmart, there's no clue associated with it. And so people don't get it right, and it's really the designer's responsibility to anticipate those issues and fix them.
There's a feature that the folks at IDEO created that sounds really good to me. I think it's one that hasn't actually been incorporated into a phone yet. It was originally designed for a cordless phone, but I think in the cell phone era, this would be a swell thing. One of the things people hate about cell phones is that, you know, people take cell phones everywhere, and they interrupt everything. They interrupt movies and shows and meetings and private conversations. Tell us about this button that was created for cordless phones.
Right. We designed this phone so for men you could slip it into your pocket, or for women you could have it in front of you, and it doesn't make an audible ring. It just flashes when it rings. So it's this silent interruption. But most importantly, for men, if you've got it in your top pocket, sticking out of your pocket is this big round button. And when you push the round button, what happens is it takes the phone off hook, and it plays a recorded message for your incoming caller that says, please hold on, I'll be with you in a moment. And so what that allows you to do, if you're in the meeting, you see this flashing light that says you've got a phone call coming in, you push the button, and you can leave the meeting before you have to speak. And so it's this great politeness feature that we designed into this phone for a Danish company that has really not been distributed in phones in the U.S., that I have seen at least.
Now, do you think that would work on cellular phones?
Oh, yeah, I think there's no reason that it wouldn't. Now, recently, everyone wants caller ID on your cell phone, and so we'd have to redesign it from our prior design so that you could look down, see who's calling, and then decide whether to push the button or just let the phone continue to flash.
My guest, Tom Kelly, is the general manager of IDEO, the design consulting company, and he's written a new book called The Art of Innovation. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Kelly. He's the author of the new book, The Art of Innovation. He's the general manager of IDEO, the design consulting company that developed the first mouse for Apple, the Crest Neat Squeeze toothpaste tube, and gazillions of stuff in between. One of the areas that your company has been asked to design for is medical equipment. And, for example, IDEO was asked to redesign an instrument used on heart patients during angioplasty. Describe what the instrument does and what your redesign, what problems your redesign answered.
Yeah, the product is for balloon angioplasty, in which they insert a catheter into the femoral artery in your leg, and then you slip this balloon up into the blocked artery in your heart, and at a very precise moment you inflate the balloon and it compacts the plaque that is in the artery and opens up the artery so more blood can flow through to it. And so the part of the product that we worked on is the inflation device. In fact, they called it the indeflator because it both inflates and deflates the balloon. When they came to us, this company was very much a leader in their field, had the market share leader product for balloon angioplasty, and they said they wanted to make a better one. We like it when clients want to make their products better. And they had their list of criteria. And right at the top of the list was must be suitable for one-handed use because they thought it was very important. It was kind of a selling feature that their competitors had launched in competition against them that this product could be used with one hand. And so we said fine, and we listened very intently. But then when we got to the next phase of work, our second phase of work is called observe, where we're out watching real people. We went into the operating room and we watched this technician who was doing nothing else other than inflating and deflating the balloon. What we discovered is they're not doing anything with the other hand. There was really no bonus. There was no real advantage to having it be for one-handed use. And in fact, the products that said they were for one-handed use really only suitable if your hand was the size of Michael Jordan's. You know, you had to have this incredible reach of your hand. And so people were using this essentially one-handed product with both hands, but it wasn't designed that way. So we said, let's design it for two-handed use. And so we have a big grip surface so that even if you have gloved hands and there's moisture on your hands, it's very easy to grip with, say, if I was doing it, your left hand, while you control the pressure on the balloon with your right hand. And we believe we made a significantly better product because we threw that specification away and went with what the observations suggested was appropriate.
There was another change you made. You say the old device made a loud clicking noise as the balloon inflated. And what was the problem with that?
Well, we really believe in designing experiences more than products. And we have something we call verbs, not nouns, that you should look at the actions, not just the physical thing. And so if you look at this balloon angioplasty procedure as an experience for the patient is awake through the process, and the surgeon will say to the technician, okay, now inflate the balloon. And this is a very delicate part of the process. You are essentially creating a mini heart attack. You are temporarily blocking this artery in the heart. And so there is some anxiety for the patient associated with this moment. With the old product, at that moment, what you would hear is this loud ratcheting noise, like some gear that had, you know, was spinning out of control or something. And it wasn't actually a problem. It just sounded scary. And so looking at it from the patient's perspective and trying to design the experience, we said, let's take that scary noise away, which we did.
Was that hard to do?
No, we did a fundamental redesign of the product in which instead of pushing a plunger down, which had these ratchets on it, which made the ratcheting noise, we twisted a pump mechanism, and it's essentially silent. So it kind of came with the design once we decided that was something we wanted to do.
Well, while we're talking about medical equipment, let's go into a hospital for a moment. Hospitals are kind of, most hospitals anyways, are kind of famous for being these really unpleasant environments that are difficult to feel healthy in. You know, they're sometimes not very conducive to feeling good, either for patients or for visitors. If you could redesign a hospital, what would you most like to fix?
Well, most of my experience in the hospital has been in the emergency room. And in the emergency room, what you really lack is information. You really want to know, when am I going to see a doctor? Where am I on the waiting list? What's the next step in my process? You know, how serious is this? You know, what's going to happen to me next? And in the book, I talk about the flying experience, which is parallel in some ways, where you're waiting for your flight and you want to know, well, what happens next? You know, am I going to get upgraded? Am I going to get on this flight? You know, when is it going to board? And I think it's that similar kind of experience. It's just that the stakes are so much higher when you're in the hospital.
So what would you do to get patients the information that they really want to have?
Well, it's really the same as the airline situation. You want to know, you know, where am I on the list? So that would be pretty easy to display. Put a monitor up on the board, and it says, you know, Kelly, you're third in line. And of course, if somebody comes in with arterial bleeding, they're gonna jump the queue. But meanwhile, I know where I am. I know what my doctor's name is. I know what their specialty is. I know what, you know, the sort of my next step is. You know, just the simple thing that used to be done well in hospitals and doesn't seem to be anymore is the idea of a patient's chart. So you know what has already happened and what's coming next by looking at a chart or an electronic equivalent of it.
Do you think that would ever fly?
Well, in the medical industry, more so than almost anywhere we work, there are these cost issues. There is the doctor could want it, the patient could want it, but there is this thing called the economic buyer, which for all intents and purposes is an insurance company. And you have to find a compelling economic reason to do this, like all the patients are going to the hospital down the street because they have this and you don't. That would make people do it.
But that's all that would make people do it.
Well, yes, they're unlikely to do it just because of improving the patient experience. They do seem to be willing to do this in the maternity ward, or the hospital in which we had both of our kids. Was very, very nicely done. They made the room, as much as possible in this sterile environment, they made the room feel a bit like home. And it was acceptable, even in the economic buyer model, to do that in the maternity ward. It's not likely it's going to be done anytime soon in the rest of the hospital.
Is that because the maternity visit is more of a planned visit? You can choose your hospital and you will shop for the better environment?
It's partly that marketing, and I think it is partly just socially acceptable to spend a little more money or put a little more into the patient experience at this very special visit to the hospital, because basically every other visit you make to the hospital is about crisis or something bad happening. It's only the visit to the maternity ward which is all positive, or, you know, is most often all positive. And so I think that, you know, even the economic buyers either have kids or were kids or something, and so they can see through to spending a little more or to putting more energy into making that space a little better.
Tom Kelly is my guest. He's the general manager of IDEO, the design consulting company, and he's written a new book called The Art of Innovation. Are there bad designs whose failures you've learned or your company's learned a lot from?
Are there are there bad designs? Have you used products? Yes.
Yes.
Yes, there, there are bad designs. I mean, there are a lot of bad designs out there. And some of them are bad, have been bad so long that you don't even really think about them. So one of my favorite examples of a bad design that's been that way forever is fireplace dampers. What is the state-of-the-art technology for determining whether your fireplace damper is open or not? I think the state-of-the-art is you stick your head into the chimney and you look up. There's got to be a better way to do that.
Right.
You know, steam irons. You know, the state-of-the-art for deciding whether your steam iron is hot or not is to put your tender fingers onto the metal of the surface. I mean, I have seen people spit on it, but it's not very polite. So most people put their hand on it to see if it's scalding hot yet or not. And it seems like it would be easily changed. I'll tell you an off-the-wall one. Men's hats. What's up with men's hats? I don't get it. You know, we live here in California where you pretty much don't need one unless you go skiing. But I was recently in both Chicago and Boston, and it is like 15 degrees out, and business people, businessmen, are not wearing hats. And I think it's because there is not a socially acceptable design. And this one's not even functionality. This has something to do with, I don't know what, style or fashion or whatever. The businessmen will not wear stocking caps. They don't, many of them want to wear a fedora. And so they are just freezing their ears off in downtown Chicago, even as we speak.
Is that the kind of thing your company would take on, designing a wearable men's hat?
Oh, sure. We'd have to have a client somewhere in the loop, of course.
Right.
So we don't do much on our own, off our own bat, as the Brits say.
Tom Kelly is general manager of the design company IDEO and author of the new book, The Art of Innovation. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Division, publisher of Total Memory Workout, 8 Easy Steps to Maximum Memory Fitness by Cynthia R. Green. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, good and bad office design. We continue our conversation with Tom Kelly, general manager of the design company IDEO. And linguist Jeff Nunberg tells us what makes him uneasy about the word literacy. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tom Kelly, general manager of the design firm IDEO. The company has worked on the design of the first Apple mouse, the Palm 5 handheld organizer, the Polaroid iZone camera, and the Crest Neat Squeeze toothpaste tube. Kelly's new book, The Art of Innovation, is about design and about creating an environment that encourages innovation. I'd like to hear what your offices look like at IDEO, how they're designed. You want to create the most creative environment possible so that the people on your teams can come up with new ideas and be comfortable and work together yet have some privacy. So what solutions have you come up with for your office design?
Well, we try something new every time we do a new building. And so if you look at every new building, there's something different. There's a different approach each time. But we found a bunch of things that work for us. One that did not come top-down from management by any means is we hang bicycles from the ceiling. One of the things in Palo Alto, California, where we're headquartered, space now, let's say flat space on the floor, is as expensive as Tokyo. It is ridiculous. It is now more expensive than Midtown Manhattan. But vertical space is more or less free. So we've got these spaces that have very, very high ceilings that everyone seems to like. And somebody a few years ago had this really nice bike that they didn't want to leave outside, and they didn't really have space for it in their office, so they hung it from the ceiling. It's probably 12 feet off the ground. And nobody reprimanded them. Nobody told them that was a bad thing to do. And so a few days later, somebody else hung one. And next thing we know, I bet we have 40 bikes hanging from the ceiling. People think it's some sort of decoration or something. It's just purely functional. If you have an expensive bike that you want to kind of keep an eye on but don't have room for in your office, you can hang it at IDEO. And so lots of people do.
A lot of corporations no longer have many private offices where you have your own room with a door that opens and closes. There's workstations where there's, you know, rows and rows of tables with the PCs on it, with maybe little dividers separating each workspace. But you really have no privacy. You hear your next-door neighbor's phone conversations. They hear yours. So there's quite a din in the area. I wonder what you think of workstations.
Well, there are a lot of variations on that approach. And so one of the things we have done is made spaces that there is a way of achieving some level of privacy. We have these translucent doors that you can slide close, and it doesn't give you total visual privacy. But what it does do is sends this very clear signal, like I'm working on something that requires a lot of focus right now. Please don't bother me. And so people in the social ecology of IDEO, people get that signal, and they will not open this sliding door to bother you. If you are in a totally open workspace like that, what we would recommend is to have a lot of what we'd call enclaves around so that you can have small rooms that you can use that are not reserved, that are just available all the time. So if you need to make a private phone call, if you want to meet one-on-one with somebody on a matter that requires some privacy, you can just kind of duck into the enclave and have that private meeting and then come back to your kind of open-air workstation.
Why do you have translucent doors? Why not opaque doors so that someone can't see through?
Gee, very good question. It was probably a design decision. It is nice to know, if you're looking for that person, it is nice to know that they're in there. You know you can't bother them right now, but you know they're in the office today. And so it's handy in that respect. But other than that, couldn't say for sure. It was a decision we made when we were building out the space.
So tell me, IDEO is located in Palo Alto, California. How are you dealing with the rolling blackouts?
Well, we have turned out all the overhead lights in our main offices so that we're cutting down our power consumption, and we are turning off computers pretty religiously and things like that. And then some of us, and I'm about to expand this, some of us have this product called a power pincher made by Steelcase that will turn off your task lamps as soon as you walk out of the room. So we are conserving everywhere we can. We have not really been hit too hard with the actual blackouts. I think we had one pretty briefly, but we just have our fingers crossed for the hot months of the summer because, you know, the cold months in the winter is not the peak period for energy consumption.
In your book, The Art of Innovation, you have a lot of suggestions for how to encourage creative thinking in a group of people working together. And you talk in part about brainstorming, what works and what's going to kill creativity in the brainstorming process. First of all, make the case for brainstorming. What is it and what's the point of doing it?
Yeah, the problem with brainstorming when I talk to our clients is they all think they do it. And so they view it as just like a threshold variable, like riding a bicycle. Do you know how to ride a bicycle? Yes. End of story. Do you do brainstorming in your organization? Yes. And they kind of check the box. But we really believe that brainstorming is more like playing a piano. It's something you can get better and better at. And as you really get skilled at it, you can get more and more rewards from it. So one of the things we would say is never confuse a brainstormer with a regular meeting. In a regular meeting, the boss gets to frame the problem and probably have the last word. In a regular meeting, people critique ideas that come up. In a regular meeting, you might go around the room and have people speak in turn, whereas none of those things would happen in a brainstormer. In a brainstormer, you would cover the walls with paper so that there's plenty of space to write. You'd have lots of colored marking pens and chocolate chip cookies and whatever it is that adds energy to the group. And people would build on the ideas of others. They'd have a bunch of wild ideas that no one would criticize because there's this rule called defer judgment. And later, you do want to do some critique, but in the brainstormer, you're going for what we call fluency and flexibility. Fluency being as many ideas as possible. We're talking about 100 to 150 ideas in a one-hour session. And then flexibility is approaching the problem or the issue you're working on from many different directions as opposed to the kind of small, medium, and large version of the same idea.
And when do you weed out the bad ideas? When do you make editorial judgments like that?
Well, after the brainstormer is done, typically the person who facilitated the brainstorm will try to summarize the ideas into some form of report or document. And the filtering of ideas begins then. So there'll be 150 ideas. They won't put all of those into the report. They'll say, gee, that was really a wild idea, but look, it led us to this new one. I'll just use the new one that has some merit to it. And so the distillation begins then, but in our setting where we work with clients, you then present the brainstorming report to the client and they say, oh, we tried that one last year. We don't think we can make that one cost effective, but gee, here's three ideas. Let's pursue these. Mm-hmm. And so that's what the screening process looks like.
In one example that you give of how to kill creativity at a brainstorming session is be totally democratic, go around the room in clockwise order, giving each person 2 minutes. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, the most painful brainstormer I ever went to was in this organization where they said, okay, we're going to do a brainstormer on, I think it was marketing opportunities on this new product they were working on. And they went around the room, yes, as you said, 2 minutes for each person. Really painful because violates all the rules of brainstorming. One of the things is build on the ideas of others. Well, if I'm 15th and I really like what the second person said, I got to wait a half an hour. By the time you get to me, I've forgotten or the group has forgotten what that idea was. There's no building on the energy. And I think that's one of the key points is there's no energy to doing it that way. And to me, brainstormers are all about energy. It's about drawing out ideas that people didn't even know they had in them because they're trying to kind of outdo the person next to them. Yeah, we could do this. We could do the pure digital one. Yeah, it could live on the web. It could do this. And they're just piling on kind of to get every idea better so that you reach this kind of crescendo of ideas and somewhere in there may be a fabulous idea. What? So if you go around the room, you don't get that energy. You get each person thinking about what they're going to say next because people have this little performance anxiety. It's a little presentation. If I'm eighth on the list, I don't hear what the seventh person's saying because I'm thinking, okay, here it comes. I got to talk. You know how people are that way.
Yeah. Tom Kelly is my guest. He's the general manager of IDEO, the design consulting company, and author of the new book, The Art of Innovation. Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Tom Kelly is my guest, general manager of the design consulting company IDEO and author of the new book, The Art of Innovation. What's the worst environment you've ever worked in? You don't have to mention the name of the company or anything, but you could just describe it.
Well, worst environment I ever worked in, that might be hard, but I'll tell you about a job I turned down.
Okay.
I got out of business school at Berkeley, and I interviewed. I had an all-day interview with this very reputable firm. And at the end of the day, I'm thinking, gee, this is sounding pretty good. And I asked this very innocent question. I said, well, gee, as a new associate joining the firm, where would I sit? And there was this awkward silence. And their first reaction, which had not come up in my all day of interviewing, was, do you know, Tom, you're going to be traveling quite a bit on this job. And I said, well, what does that mean? Well, you don't exactly have your own dedicated desk. You know, and this was before the idea of hoteling came up, which is actually quite common in offices now. But you don't really have your own desk. I said, well, okay, well, where do I put my stuff? Well, you put your stuff in the back room. Well, can I see the back room? And so there's just, I'm meeting all this resistance. And so finally, because I kind of insisted, they took me into the back room. And here in the back room is this set of shelves. And I don't mean nice shelves. No, I don't mean wood shelves. I mean the cheapest, nastiest gray metal utility shelves that you can buy at Home Depot, you know, was there in the back room for the associates to put their stuff on. And then the crushing blow. I'm not saying this is rational that this put me off so much, but the crushing blow for me was even on this cheap metal utility shelf, I didn't get my own shelf. On the left of the shelf, they took a cheap piece of masking tape and wrote on it with a blue pen, Henderson. And then on the right, they would have written Kelly had I joined this prestigious firm. And, you know, that space just spoke volumes to me about what the firm felt about new associates. You know, I knew that if I joined this firm, I was going to be a cog in the wheels of industry, you know, that they really didn't care about me. And you know what? I turned down that job. So I think there's a message there somewhere for companies. Maybe, you know, I'm so quirky it doesn't matter. No one else ever had that same impression. But if it keeps talented people away because you've got something toxic in your work environment, gee, that's pretty bad, because I think almost every CEO in America, that's top of their list, is attracting, retaining talented people.
Well, that's a great story. Do you have a personal pet peeve that you haven't mentioned?
Well, I do have one that is fading. It will go away soon, but it's airline tickets. You ever look at your airline ticket and try to find out, what time does my flight leave and what time does it arrive at its destination? The departure time is buried somewhere in all that messy text.
That is so true.
The arrival time, I believe, is not on there anywhere. There's all sorts of codes and 17-digit numbers and stuff. Those are for somebody else other than me, because I can't hardly find my flight number or the departure time.
That would be easy to fix, wouldn't it?
That would be very easy to fix.
But I guess the tickets are more for the people at the airlines than for the passengers.
That's true, but, you know, I'm the person who just paid $2,000 for
my
flight from San Francisco
so
to Chicago. Yeah. Right.
Oh, would you redesign the bathrooms on airplanes while you're at it?
Well, you know, the bathrooms on airplanes are actually pretty amazing if you think about it. They have such an incredibly small amount of space to deal with, and this thing's got to be durable, you know, for years of the life of the aircraft. I would say, yes, there are things we could improve, but it's not on my bug list. It is pretty good, all things considered, if you figure out all the constraints that are on that product or that environment.
I'm not sure whether this is more of a design problem or an ethical problem, but on planes and on some trains, the passenger in front of you can relax by putting their seat back, thus completely cramping you. So, like, one person's comfort is at the expense of another person's ability to, you know, have any leg room at all. How would you solve that problem?
Well, this gets at the social aspects of innovation or design, and these can be some of the trickiest issues to deal with. For example, with cellular telephony, if everybody's got a cell phone and everybody's got caller ID, you have to explain to me why you're not taking my call. You know, there's this social inhibition that's going to come up, you know, when technology gets ahead of society. And so this thing with the airline seat, it's really a question of social ecology or protocol or whatever. And so, yes, we could certainly design a seat. Well, you know, you can add more space. You know, there are these seats now in United Airlines has just launched them where you can sit back as far as you want and you don't impinge on the other person's space. But in doing so, they fit fewer seats on the aircraft. And so if you want to pack the aircraft as much as possible, which airlines want to do and we as passengers want to do because we want the tickets to be as cheap as possible, then it's inherently a trade-off. It becomes a kind of zero-sum game. And the only way to do it would be to make it so that your space kind of overlaps with their space in a way that is more comfortable than the current approach.
I have a question for you. I have a digital watch. The watch that I recently bought can only do about three or four things. It can tell you the time. Mm-hmm. It can be a stopwatch, which I really need it to be. And it can be an alarm. All good things. Mm-hmm. The watch I had before that could also be a phone book. You could store all kinds of other information in it. I could never comprehend the instructions well enough to make any of those other functions work. And I vowed that I wouldn't waste all that kind of the extra money and whatever on those features that just frustrated me and served no function because I couldn't figure out how to use them. And I probably wouldn't have had the time to program in all the phone numbers anyways. Is that what you call feature creep, where there's more features than anyone's really going to use?
That's exactly what we call feature creep, and you really do have to resist the temptation of that. It's particularly prevalent in the PC industry, where reviewers make these big grids, these feature grids. And so they've got four products they're reviewing, and then they've got these 152 features, and you either get a check mark or you don't get a check mark in that box. And so everybody wants to get a check mark on that box. You know, does automatic translation into Arabic? Check. You know, allows for time to be moving in a negative direction? Check. And so it's just so tempting for companies. They just want to check off the box. But we think that customers will reward them for making simplicity in these products. My current pet peeve is alarm clocks. We had this wonderful alarm clock, had it for 20 years. It had kind of set the alarm, set the time, or just run. And that was all it had, and that was all it really needed. Now, I cannot find an alarm clock that doesn't have the A alarm and the B alarm. And so my wife got one that has the A and the B, and we can't set it to save our lives. In fact, we have the only solution we've come up with as an interim solution to throwing it away and buying a new one is we've turned the volume on the radio down so that you can't hear it. Otherwise, it just seems to wake up at random times in the middle of the night. And I do have National Public Radio, by the way, on the alarm clock on my side of the bed. But on her side of the bed, it is totally silent because we can't figure this thing out. And we have just literally thrown away two alarm clocks that our kids got as presents for the same reason. They would just randomly wake us up in the middle of the night. I even unplugged them, and that didn't help because it has some sort of fail-safe mode that says, okay, when there's no power, I'm not going to run the CD, I'm not going to run the radio. I'll just run this incredibly annoying beeping noise at 4 a.m. So there's an opportunity for somebody. I hope somebody out there is listening.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Tom Kelly is the general manager of the design company IDEO, which is based in Palo Alto, California. He's also the author of the new book, The Art of Innovation. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg tells us why the word literacy makes him uneasy. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The Bush family has always treated literacy as a personal cause, and the president has made it a central element in his new education package. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg thinks this is all to the good, but he's troubled by the use of the word itself.
For the last 150 years or so, Americans have regarded literacy as an absolute public good. I'd be the last to quarrel with that. It's only the word literacy itself that makes me uneasy. Actually, literacy and literate have been around since the Renaissance as a way of describing an educated person, which usually meant somebody who knew Greek or Latin. But literate and illiterate were pretty recondite words until the late 19th century, when Americans started to use them to classify people according to whether they had the basic ability to read and write. That was the moment when literacy became a civic virtue, the key to creating the responsible public that a democracy required. As one reformer put it, universal education is the lever that will elevate the social state of the poor, assimilating them in habits, thoughts, and feelings to the rich and the educated. That was the great age of the American Public Library movement, and the time when people started to measure literacy rates as the best indicator of social development. Ever since then, literacy and illiteracy have led double lives in English. They refer both to basic skills and to broader cultural and intellectual achievements. And over the course of the 20th century, Americans have extended the notion of literacy to cover skills and knowledge that don't seem to have any immediate connection to basic reading and writing. The phrases media literacy and economic literacy first appeared about 50 or 60 years ago, and in the following decades, people began to talk about geographical literacy, scientific literacy, computer literacy, and mathematical literacy. By 1987, the critic E.D. Hirsch could coin the term cultural literacy to cover all the information that Americans need to know in order to function as informed citizens. Who was Horace Greeley? What was the Stamp Act? Where is Stuttgart? When was the 30 Years' War? And shortly after that, William Bennett started talking about moral literacy, by which he meant the ethical standards that all American children ought to be taught, the values they could presumably pick up from the uplifting tales in Bennett's Book of Virtues. There's something very curious about the way we use the word literacy. At least, I don't know of any other language that has a single word that covers this range of territory. When the French or Italians want to talk about the basic ability to read and write, they use terms based on the word alphabet. Somebody who doesn't have those skills is called analphabetic. Basic literacy campaigns are called alphabetization campaigns, and so forth. But when it comes to describing the other kinds of knowledge that Americans call literacies of one kind or another, Europeans use other words like learning or culture. If you want to translate computer literacy into Italian, you'd say something like la cultura del computer. And if you wanted to talk about cultural literacy, you'd have to say something like la cultura della cultura, though that expression wouldn't make a lot of sense. Of course, there are a lot of words in English that don't have exact translations in other languages. Smug, for example, or empowerment. But that's often a sign that some cultural sleight of hand is going on. The fact is that there's nothing natural or obvious about using the same word to describe the basic ability to read and write and the general knowledge and values that we want our citizens to have. In part, all this talk of literacies reflects the skittishness that Americans have about using the word culture as a positive term. We have no problem using culture to describe the traditions and mores of particular groups and communities, like when we talk about hip-hop culture or the culture of people who travel around in RVs. And there's a growing tendency to use the phrase the culture to refer to the custard of values and prejudices that we're all swimming around in. But we're uncomfortable about using the bare noun culture all by itself. A phrase like a person of culture has an elitist public television ring to it. And nobody would get very far trying to argue that the schools are failing in their duty to turn out cultivated citizens. That would be a perfectly natural thing to say in French, but in American English, the adjective cultivated is reserved for seniors who are trying to describe themselves in a personal ad. Since the 19th century, the word literacy has been our way of getting culture in through the back door of the schoolroom. Literacy strips culture of its connotations of class and refinement and turns it into a civic duty and a subject matter, something you can objectify and measure. At that point, it becomes natural to start compiling lists of all the things that people ought to know, particularly given the American passion for quantification. If learning about citizenship or morality is the same sort of thing as learning to read and write, then we ought to be able to set down the subject in a dictionary, the same way we do with words and spellings. Of course, as soon as anybody publishes one of these lists, people start to quibble with its contents. Why list Horace Greeley rather than Marcus Garvey? But that's how people always greet the appearance of a new dictionary. And in the long run, the disputes just validate the appropriateness of treating culture as an exercise in lexicography. There's always been an element of social control in the way Americans think about literacy. The 19th century founders of the public library movement believed that universal literacy was the best way of inoculating the working class against the blandishments of radical orators. But there was also a sincere hope that once people learned to read and write, they'd be exposed to a world of experience where everything wasn't codified in advance. That idea is a little blurred in the way we use literacy now, where we make the mastery of basic reading and writing the model for everything that ought to happen in the classroom. It runs the risk of reducing the whole of education to a spelling bee.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shirok directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Next month, Russian scientists will deorbit the space station Mir and send it back to Earth. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from astronaut Jerry Lininger. During his 5 months on the Russian space station, he faced inadequate supplies, constant system failures, and a life-threatening fire. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.